Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Fantastic to see such a packed out room for this event on mental health and the importance of mental health. Delighted to see you all here. My name's Mark Williamson. I'm Director of Action for Happiness. I see many familiar, friendly faces who've been to our events before. Warm welcome to all of you, but also to anyone who's not joined us before. Very glad to have you here. Action for Happiness, for those of you who aren't familiar with us, we're a movement of people united by a common belief that happiness and well-being really matter. They matter to us, obviously, as individuals and for our loved ones, but they also matter in terms of our priorities for the society we live in. And that's really at the heart of tonight's theme, really, and the fact that when we care about happiness and well-being, then mental health is a vitally important component of that. So I'm delighted we have two such eminent, distinguished and sort of action-focused speakers here this evening, and I'm sure you'll be very informed and inspired by what they have to say. But actually, as you know, our name, Action for Happiness, is about more than just being informed and inspired. And hopefully, if you've been to any of our events before and connected with us in other ways, you know that we care about trying to inspire action and doing things differently. So this evening, we'd like to experiment with something a little bit different to what we've done in previous events. We sent an email out to those of you who'd registered earlier on today. We really feel that, of course, the world needs to change and we want a happy society. Much of the things around us need to change, but actually that we can each play a part in contributing to that change. So our invitation to all of us tonight really is to think, as we listen to the content this evening, as we discuss it and share our reactions to it, to think, what can I do? What can I perhaps do to contribute to this issue? What change can I make either personally or collectively with colleagues and friends, loved ones, or also in terms of what I campaign for, what I care about in society? So what you'll find on your seats, and we'll come back to a little bit later on, is a prompt sheet and an action card. And after we've heard from our speakers this evening, we'll perhaps think a little moment about what we can each do to help put some of this into practice. So I hope you'll join us in embracing that idea and getting involved. Very much looking forward to your contribution and your questions, as always. We have, of course, copies of Richard and David's wonderful book, which we'll have a chance to, you may have seen on the way in, and a chance to get at the end if you're interested. But really, you know, that's the sort of building block for this event and why we're focusing on this theme this evening. There's a fabulous amount of both experience and vitally important points that are made in this book, and I think David and Richard will be sharing with us this evening why this matters so much, but also why it's so connected to this wider agenda we have with Action for Happiness. So I'm particularly delighted we have Richard here this evening to lead us off, because Richard, of course, is really the reason all of us are here. He is the co-founder and, of course, in many ways, the original pioneering thinker behind what led to Action for Happiness. And actually, we haven't heard from one of these events for quite some time, in fact, since our launch event. So I'm very excited to hear Richard's take on how this has all evolved over the 3 or 4 years we've been doing this, and of course, how his work has led him to this particular topic. Richard really needs no introduction, but of course, is a pioneering economist and has been working in the field of happiness and well-being for a decade or more, and one of the world's experts in this topic. Joining him is his co-author of this book, David Clark, Professor of Psychology at Oxford, who is one of the world's leading experts in psychological therapies. And one of the most empowering and important things we're going to hear tonight is this idea that we can help people deal more effectively and recover from mental health challenges. And David has been such a leading figure in making that happen in our health service and across the UK more broadly. So please join me in welcoming our two speakers this evening, and in particular Richard will speak first, and then David will speak, and then we'll have a short discussion on stage and then open this up for a wider conversation. So please welcome Richard Blair.
Well, this is actually the first time I've ever spoken to an IACT audience since our launch. I don't know how I've managed to escape so long, but it's lovely to be here. And it's led me to reflect on the extraordinary progress that this movement has made since we had that launch 3.5 years ago. We've now got 35,000 members who've taken the pledge to try and create more happiness in the world and less misery. We've got about 1 million people following our wonderful website. And next year, and I hope you've all got your diaries here, on the 21st of September, the Dalai Lama will be launching Mark's wonderful new a course, which is called Exploring What Matters. And we hope that on the back of that course, And we will move beyond being mainly a web-based organisation to an organisation that consists of thousands of face-to-face groups who support and stimulate each other to lead better lives. So, if I think, how did this all get to this point? I realise that it's all down to one person only. I don't need to say who, but I do want to say today, to take the chance of saying that we owe Mark an incredible debt of gratitude, and I want to say that before I say anything else. Now, also looking back to our launch, there's been a lot of movement in the policy world in relation to happiness as an objective for policymakers. Since then, actually, nearly every OECD government has started regular measurement of the happiness of its population. Extraordinary development. And more policymakers are beginning to think that policies should actually be aimed at enabling people to lead happy lives rather than just wealthy lives or whatever else. There was a very important report, which I hope some of you have seen, called the O'Donnell Report, that was produced under the auspices of the Legatum Institute. You can find it on their website, which worked out really in some detail what would it mean for a government and local government to adopt the happiness of the population as its objective. And I think that's a very great step forward to have a sort of locus classicus that people can go back to see that it has been seriously thought through what you would do differently. But the most interesting convert to this cause is Mrs. Merkel. She's going to be president of the G7 next year, and as of now, she's planning to make, she uses the word well-being, to use the word well-being as the theme for her G7 presidency, and there'll be another World Happiness Report that's produced in conjunction with that. So a lot of progress there. And if I ask myself, well, if we really did make happiness the objective of government policy, what would we do differently? Of course, the first thing that comes to mind is take mental health and mental health problems a lot more seriously. So I've been looking over the last few years at many countries, the survey data in many countries, and I always find that the greatest single cause of misery in every country is mental health problems. So just to explain what I mean, if you take the most miserable people in every country, say the people who are least satisfied with their lives, and then you ask, what facts do we know about them? In all cases, we know that more of them are suffering from mental health problems than from physical health problems, and many more are suffering from mental health problems than from poverty or from unemployment, which are the subjects I spent most of my working life studying. But it seems to me that we now have to have a completely new concept of deprivation. We cannot go on thinking of deprivation simply in terms of lack of material means. Deprivation means that you cannot enjoy your life for whatever reason, not just the external reasons, but also the reasons that come from inside your own mental life. So we also need a new concept of the welfare state. So if you go back to when Beveridge launched the sort of basic principles of the welfare state after the war, you had the five giants which were holding people back. And these were mainly features of a person's external experience and circumstances. And of course, since the war, all those five giants have been very largely tamed. Unemployment less than the others, but the others have all been tamed, totally transformed, and yet we know from surveys that the population is no happier now than it was 60 years ago. This is a huge challenge to any social policy maker. How could it be that we've had all this social policy, all this improvement, all this welfare state, and it hasn't delivered a happier life? And I think it's quite obvious what went wrong. We left out the person within. We thought that if we changed the external circumstances, that was sufficient to produce a happy life, and we ignored the problems which arise inside the person. And I think that that is the sixth giant. Mental health is the sixth giant, which was left out and needs to be incorporated as a sixth pillar of the welfare state. I'd like a cabinet minister, if we could have one, for mental health. So let me just very quickly say something about the impact of mental health problems, then what can be done about them, and then what you can do to help that to happen. Very quickly, we've got 1 in 6 adults suffering from diagnosable depression or anxiety disorders at the moment. A great deal of suffering involved for them and their families, but also a huge cost to the rest of society. And I just want to mention those points because these are the real campaigning points, unfortunately. Suffering is not an easy campaigning point, but cost to society is an easier campaigning point. I'm sure I'm preaching to the converted, but let me give you some tools to campaign with. The two big impacts, of course, are of mental illness. It makes it much more difficult to work effectively or even to work at all, so that the half of all absenteeism, time off, is due to mental health problems, and half of all the people on disability benefits, paid for by the rest of society, are there because of mental health problems. That's one problem. But the other, that people are less aware of, I think, is the huge impact of mental health problems on a person's physical health, and therefore on their use of the physical healthcare system. So here's an extraordinary fact, that depression reduces your life expectancy as much as smoking. If we could get that into the heads of the public health world, we might begin to see some sensible notices going up in GP surgeries. And if we ask, what is the impact of this on the health care system, we can show that for a person with a given physical health problem, they will be using 50% more NHS resources on their physical health care for a whole variety of reasons. So there's a massive cost, something like 10 billion to the NHS, of the extra physical health care demanded by people because of their mental health problem. So you would have thought, wouldn't you? By now we would have got organised to treat these problems. But what is the fact? The fact is that only 1/4 of people who have mental health problems are in treatment, as compared with 90% or more of people who have physical health problems. And this is not because we don't have good treatments, it's because we're not making them available. So David will be saying what the treatments are, but let me just make the broad point that not only, of course, does medication help some conditions, but much more importantly, NICE recommends that psychological therapies should be provided for all mental health conditions, and in fact, they're provided for very few of those people who have those problems, which is shocking for 2 reasons. It's shocking as a simple matter of social justice. And personally, when I hear the phrase health inequality, I find it extraordinary. It only includes inequalities between social classes. It doesn't include inequalities between different health conditions. But there's complete inequality in the treatment of people with mental health and physical health problems. That's the most extreme health inequality in our country. So it's a matter of justice. It's also a matter of efficiency. That actually, because of what I said about the cost to society of mental illness, if we treat more people and make a decent proportion of them better, we will save so much of those costs to society that it will cost us nothing to be providing the extra psychological therapy. So that's the case which we've made with some success, that if we had psychological therapy, evidence-based, NICE recommended psychological therapy, available to more people, the savings first on benefits would be sufficient to pay for the whole cost. But more important in the world that it is, the savings to the rest of the NHS would be great enough to cover the whole cost. So this is a point that we have to make to these commissioners. You know, all our fate, young and old, is in the hands of these NHS commissioners who decide whether or not we get treated. They're called clinical commissioning groups now. These are the people that we have to address to get them to take mental health seriously. And in the devolved NHS, there's only a certain amount that the centre can any longer do. An awful lot is left of these commissioners, and they need to be approached by people like everyone in this room. So what can you do to help? Well, the service which we now have in Britain for providing psychological therapy is called Improved Access to Psychological Therapy, or IAPT. It started in 2008. It was designed and has essentially been led by David absolutely brilliantly for the last 6 years. It's got to the point where it's considered to be the world's best psychological therapy system in any country in the world. And at least 10 other countries are thinking of copying it. So it's been a success with, of course, deficiencies and problems on the way, but it's simply not large enough. So here's the key fact I want to tell you. At the moment, every commissioner is meant to be ensuring that 15% of the people in need, those people who would be diagnosed with depression and anxiety disorders, are seen by this service. 15%. Not a great target, but that's what they're meant to do. Some achieve it, some overachieve it, but there's a huge number, the majority, are way below. That is shocking. They are cutting, in some cases even, the service, and in other cases they think it's an easy way to save a bit of money. Nobody's going to cause a fuss if we don't provide this service. So the first thing is to get onto the commissioners. And Mark is going to put onto the website in due course material which will tell you how your local commissioner is doing so that you can harass them if either they're not providing for enough treatments or that not enough of their patients are recovering. At least 50% should be recovering within the period of treatment. But then there's another issue. I mean, 15% is pretty awful target, isn't it? So we have been campaigning, a number of us, for the manifestos of every political party to raise this 15% figure to 25% by the end of the next parliament. And that's, of course, an issue for MPs and so on. So please also get on to your MP and say, we expect your party manifesto to have a serious uplift in treatment for people with mental health problems. We're recommending 25% of need by 2020 for adults and 33% for children that I haven't had time to mention. So please write your MP. The phrase, you know, there's a banner phrase always that you have to use, which gets under the skin. Parity of esteem is a phrase. So we put into, the present government actually put into law the obligation on the NHS to practice parity of esteem between mental and physical illness. Of course, we're nowhere near it. And these are the kinds of steps, practicable steps, which could be taken to move us in that direction. I'm thinking back to the launch of our movement, I'm reminded of the interview when we interviewed Mark and a number of other candidates. And one of the candidates had been into the web to see if there was any other organisation, NGO, that had the word happiness in its title. Quite an interesting question. And this is the answer that came back on his screen. your search for happiness has produced no results. I'm quite sure we can do better than that. With your help, we will attack and make major inroads into the problem of mental illness. Thank you very much.
I'm here as Richard's co-author, and I'm sort of one of the products of his action. He felt that we should write a book explaining about treatments of mental health problems. What I'd like to say really is that the main message of that book, Thrive, is that the prospects for people with mental health problems have dramatically changed in recent years. Over the last 25 years, there's been enormous progress in developing effective psychological treatments for a very wide range of mental health problems. Much of that progress has been made by very tight research programs which link experimental studies trying to understand what it is that's keeping a mental health problem going with clinical interventions that try and focus on the discoveries of those psychological experiments largely. And much of it has been done by British psychotherapists, so it's a sort of area of great progress here in the UK. That has been recognised by the government, the government's body which is charged with looking at what's effective in physical and mental health is the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, or NICE, and that now recommends psychological treatments as first choice interventions for depression, for all different anxiety disorders, so things like social anxiety, panic, agoraphobia, other phobias, generalized anxiety, to finding yourself worrying much more and feeling it's out of control, obsessive compulsive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Also, for the different eating disorders, bulimia, anorexia nervosa, and for a range of different personality disorders. So that's enormous progress at the research end. But the big scandal is very few people in the UK or elsewhere in the world are receiving those treatments. As you heard from Richard, there has been progress in developing treatment services for anxiety and depression. But at the moment, only 13% of people in the community with anxiety or depression get offered an evidence-based psychological treatment. Now, that's a scandal because there are many surveys that have looked at what the public would like. And people have often been asked, would you prefer a psychological treatment or a drug treatment if they're equally effective? And the public replies in a sort of ratio of 3-1 that they would prefer psychological treatments. They're willing to engage in them, they're willing to spend the time with them, and of course they're particularly interested in the fact that in a psychological treatment, you learn something about how to manage difficulties and setbacks in the future. So it sets you up for the long term. Whereas for many of the medications we find in the research studies, that when you stop taking the medication, a sizable proportion of people will relapse. So what are the impediments to making these treatments more widely available? Well, the first impediment is the way that we talk about them. They're often discussed in the media as the talking therapies. But that is really a misnomer, and it seriously misrepresents them. They are, of course, they all involve meeting a therapist who's very interested in you, spends time talking to you, gives you an opportunity to talk about things confidentially, and is very sympathetic. We would all like that if we're in difficulty. But I think many people find it difficult to understand that that alone could cure some very serious mental health problems. But that alone isn't what happens in these treatments. They are much more specific procedures based on research which helps us understand what it is that's maintaining the problem. And until we can change the way we think about them or describe them, people won't really understand quite how significant pay off. So I'll give you three brief examples. I'll take one from an anxiety problem, something called panic disorder. People with panic disorder often find that if they're walking along the street and feeling reasonably calm, they suddenly notice their heart racing, they feel short of breath, and they often think they're going to die or faint or collapse. It's a very frightening experience, and many people will also develop agoraphobia because of that. The research shows that what's happening there is people just develop mistaken beliefs about fairly normal body sensations. So they think, for example, if I have a missed heartbeat, that means I'm going to have a heart attack. And when you have that thought, of course, it makes you very anxious, and then you get more changes in increasing heart rate, shortness of breath, you are more convinced you're going to have a heart attack, and it sort of spirals up into a panic in no time at all. And what people then do is they do what we call safety behaviors. They try and take the strain off their heart. So someone who has that experience might sit down and try and relax and try and slow down their breathing. And if they don't die, they'll think afterwards, that's only because I did all these things to save myself. But I've really got a serious physical condition. And so the therapy has to involve helping them understand that actually they're in very good shape and it's just their fearful beliefs that's the problem. And one of the good ways that you would do that is actually to look at what they normally do and do the opposite. So normally when they get the sensations, they'll relax and slow down their breathing. But in therapy, you might get them to dwell on these fearful thoughts for a while, generate some of the sensations, and then do the opposite of relaxing. You might suggest that they come out of the therapy room and have a little bit of a jog with you. And as they're jogging along, they might start to feel a bit of tightness in their chest. And you would say, and how are you doing now? Do you think you're going to die? And say, no, not yet, but if it gets a bit worse, okay, but you know, this is a really good way of testing out. Why don't we go for the burn? Running like that when they feel in danger has an enormous effect on their beliefs and makes them much more reassured that their heart is fine. Of course, that could be a very frightening exercise to do though in therapy, couldn't it? So there's a lot of discussion beforehand to entice someone into doing that sort of test, that sort of behavioural bit, the test, and the discussion is the cognitive bit. So you might, for example, get someone to, you might ask them, have you ever had a panic attack and then in the middle of the attack something's happened which has really distracted you? Say, one of the children has been about to drop one of your favourite vases or something like that and you've suddenly been distracted. And they might say, well, not often, but yes, a couple of times. Okay, now, when you were distracted, what happened to those sensations and what happened to the panic? And they'll often say, well, they'd actually stopped. So I really wanted to grab the vase. I said, okay. So how does that fit with the idea you're having a heart attack? You think cardiologists would say, forget about